from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
This is Robert Siegel, former host of NPR's All Things Considered. Great Podversations features nationally recognized writers and journalists in candid conversation about books and ideas. Great Podversations is produced by the University of Louisville, Kentucky Author Forum. It's an honor for me to continue my long relationship with this series, which televises its forums on PBS affiliates as Great Conversations. Today, author Anna Quindlen discusses her book, Write for Your Life, with writer Amy Bloom. Anna Quindlen is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, novelist, and opinion columnist. She is the best-selling author of 9 novels, including Every Last One and Still Life with Breadcrumbs. Her memoir, Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake, published in 2012, was a #1 New York Times bestseller. Quindlen's book, A Short Guide to a Happy Life, has sold more than 1 million copies. While a columnist at the New York Times, Quindlen won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. Amy Bloom is the author of 4 novels and 3 collections of short stories. Her first book of nonfiction, Normal, Transsexual CEOs, Cross-Dressing Cops, and Hermaphrodites with Attitudes, is a staple of university sociology and biology courses. Her most recent book is the widely acclaimed New York Times best-selling memoir, In Love. Bloom has written for magazines such as The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, Vogue, Elle, The Atlantic Monthly, Slate, and Salon. And her work has been translated into 15 languages. She is the Shapiro Silverberg Professor of Creative Writing at Wesleyan University. We hope you'll enjoy this great podversation with Anna Quindlen and Amy Bloom.
I am so happy to be here with you, Anna. I am so happy to talk about your new book, which I think has both joy and a little urgency, which is not always what you see in a book about writing.
Well, thanks, Amy. I'm always delighted to talk with you. And by the way, we're not just going to talk about my new book. We're going to talk about yours, too.
Oh, all right. I think we can talk about both books. I think that a lot of what we think and feel about writing is actually very similar. I think a lot of the same forces propel us. But I do want to ask you, because you never wrote a book like this before, I'm pretty sure, since I'm pretty familiar with your work. Did something in particular sort of start pushing this boulder down the hill for you?
I think I've been saving string on this one for years and years. I mean, I would encounter some writing program like the Freedom Writers, which I mentioned in the first chapter, that was really changing lives through writing. Or I would encounter a website like Flea Market Love Letters that would remind me of how important letters had been over the years. Or I'd be talking to a biographer who had drawn heavily on journals and letters from someone to write a biography. And over time, I kept thinking, we've lost writing. We don't feel that way because at the end of the day, maybe we've churned out 20 emails and endless texts. But in terms of thoughtful, discursive writing about our own lives, I think we've backed off from that. And I think this is a perfect moment to revisit it. You know, we talk all the time about how our lives are so filled with stress and anxiety. And what we've learned from actual research is that stress and anxiety can be lessened by writing down what we're thinking and feeling.
I mean, I certainly find that to be true. Are you the kind of person who thinks more clearly after you've written, or do you mostly think it through and then write it down?
I think I interrogate things, particularly things about what I believe, more thoroughly when I've looked at them written down. I mean, there's that old saw, and no one knows who said it, how do I know what I think until I read what I write? And when I was a columnist, I remember hell for leather, writing down a paragraph about something and reading it over and thinking, that's not what I believe. Oh my goodness, what have I done here? And I think that's true of people who aren't writers too. I think simultaneously, writing down what's going on in your life can do two things at the same time, which are in opposition to each other, which is so interesting to me. They can both elevate things. You write down some ordinary experience and revisit it a month later and think, this was a lot more important than I thought it was. And conversely, you can write down something that's really distressing you. And when you read it, you go, oh, this isn't so bad. And I think given the fact that we do talk all the time about this need for connection and for self-examination, that we have this tool at our disposal for everyone that we're missing an opportunity on. And that's really what made me write the book.
How do you feel you can help people who really don't? I mean, even people who pick up the book and who are like, well, I like the idea, but I'm no writer. I don't write anything. I do my business emails, or I'm a retired person. I don't write anything for anybody except a grocery list. What do you feel could help those people besides your encouragement? How do they put their toe in the water?
Well, one woman who read the book early on said to me that she has a journal that she keeps. And on the first page, she wrote, an attitude of gratitude. And she only writes once a week on Sunday mornings. It's almost a religious connection to her. And all she writes is a couple of paragraphs about what has happened in the last week that she's grateful for. And she's done this for, I think she said, 6 years. And when she looks back over those early journals, they help her not only chart the progression of her life, but to feel better about where she is, because in fact, she sees that she has had so much to be grateful for. So I think to anyone who's saying, I don't have time to sit down and write every day, or I don't have time to write at length, or I don't know what to write about, she's a good model. There's that Alice Munro quote, which I love, which is in the book, where she lists all the things she doesn't know how to do. And then she says, but there's always time for looking out the window. And looking out the window is always a good writing prompt. And for those who think, I can't do this and there's not really a point to me doing it, I think I go back to a line in the book where I say, if you could look down and see words on paper from anyone living or dead, who would it be? And if that would be of great value to you, don't you think that you should pay it forward, that you should provide that for someone else, for anyone who has a family, for anyone who's concerned about the play of history? I just think taking a little bit of time to write things down can make a real difference. I'm really struck by the fact that in your words fail me almost, in your incredibly beautiful new book, In Love, which is about your husband's diagnosis with Alzheimer's and his determination to end his life in his own way, in his own time. Your epigraph is, please write about this, my husband said. And as I read that, I thought a couple of things. One was that it was obvious that he would say this to you, since you are such a wonderful writer. The second is that at some level, for those people out there reading the book and saying, this is terribly intimate, it's a sense of permission for you to write about it. But the other thing is that, leaving aside the fact that you're a writer, when we write about things, they become more real, more actual, when they're actually in front of us. And I couldn't help but think that your husband was saying, give this life, in a way that I think anyone can do when they're writing.
I think so. And, you know, sort of very much along the lines that you were talking about, the book came about because I had a little several tatty little notebooks filled with notes that are the kinds of notes that caregivers have, you know, get B12 supplements, gym appointment at 3, who's taking Brian? I mean, so, and everybody who takes care of anybody, whether you're taking care of your kids or you're taking care of your parents, everybody has notes like this. And that was really the spine of the book, were these little notebooks, you know, covered with coffee stains, probably, and tear stains. And they were sort of the center of it. And then I could begin to think about where I was or what I was doing. And I think when people say, I don't know what to write about, I think it's partially a reluctance to write about your feelings. And I think that, you know, people often feel that way about talking about their feelings as well. It's, you know, part of, I hope it does give people permission, because part of what I think, everybody has feelings, you know, they're not optional. I remember one of my kids saying to me, I don't want to feel sad about this. And I said, it's not like air conditioning. It's not optional. You know, if you're sad, you're going to be sad. But being able to put on a piece of paper, I feel sad. If you sat with that sentence for a minute, you would be able to write about what you feel sad about.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely true. And I also think there's a tendency, and I wonder if this is more true of women than of men, to think that the small moments of life are not worth writing about. And then you circle back to something like The Diary of a Young Girl by Anne Frank and realize that while we tend to think of it as a Holocaust document, all it is an enumeration of small moments, of all those little annoyances and events that take place in that attic. And one of the reasons why I feel like our history, the history that most of our children learn, is both so incomplete and so tedious at some level, is because it's missing that feeling of real life that I think, I'm going to generalize here, overwhelmingly women bring to the table. I mean, your book is about great issues and broad strokes, about life and death, about love and loss, but it's also about all of those small moments that you and your husband have together leading up to the end of his life. And that's why it's so powerful, because we live in it.
We do. And everybody's life is. I mean, I sometimes think if you could see the intimate details of anybody's life, it would be illuminating. And part of it is that people often don't want to be illuminated. You know, there are a lot of things that people prefer to keep to themselves. And some journals and diaries that people keep are clearly in expectation of being read. I don't imagine if I'm going to read Fran Lebowitz's journals that I'm going to discover a whole different side of her, cuddly, loving, let me go out with the puppies and the kittens and the ball of yarn. I don't think that will be revealed. Likewise, Melania Trump's journals. I don't feel like a whole different person will be revealed. But for lots of us, those small moments do reveal. And I think that sometimes people are also a little reluctant about that, even with themselves. A friend of mine said about herself, I'm really good at overlooking, and it has served me really well. And I remember I had gone through this with a friend who had really had some physical difficulties, and I kept trying to get her to go to physical therapy because it affected her spine and her back. And a really close friend of mine, an older psychiatrist, said to me, I know it's not for you, but for some people, denial is a great help. It's a great comfort. And so I think maybe one of the struggles people face about writing about their feelings, even if it's once a week, is how do I look at what maybe I'm a little reluctant to look at, or how do I write and still leave all those other things to the side? Because it is true that once you start writing, the overlooking is a little harder. Although you do get those great journals from like the 19th century in which people are basically put up 17 jars of beans today.
Exactly.
Period.
Exactly.
And maybe that's not a bad way to go. You know, what did you do?
Your writing doesn't necessarily have to look inside. Sometimes it can look outside at the world around you, and that's valuable. I mean, there's a letter that I quote in the book from a nurse who's taking care of young men in Washington during a pandemic, except it's the flu epidemic of 1918. And it's not so much that she bares her soul as that we read some of the details of what's going on and think, well, that's exactly what happened to us. And I think one of the things that writing can do for us, not only writing that goes inside, but writing that looks at the world around us, is make us feel less alone. I mean, that's what reading does for me. That's what writing does for me. I read In Love, and it touched on so many issues in my own life that was incredibly powerful. I just think that opportunity to connect in a world that often feels like it's rife with disconnection is invaluable.
I agree. I think the underlining that it's fine to write about what is outside, that people don't have to dig into their souls. They can also pay attention. They can write about the garden. They can write about the miscommunication. They can write about the book they read. They can write about the clouds scudding across the sky. I think for me, I'm a huge Jane Austen fan, but the things that really grabbed me were her letters to her sister, because there is this other side of Jane Austen. And I have to say, by the time I got to see Jane Austen's brother's house, the lucky brother who was raised as an aristocrat, unlike the rest of the Austens who are raised poor as church mice, I felt her so strongly that I was beside myself. You know, we're going through, the nice lady is showing us, oh, and here's the lovely room in which she wrote. And I am enraged. I'm like, the lovely room? She had a bad back. They gave her a rickety little table and a terrible lamp and no cushion on the chair. Are you kidding me? But all of these were the details from her letters, and they were so present for me. I felt like I was sticking up for a mistreated friend. And I think that is part of what you get from letters, from revealing. And you know, a lot of it is her interior, but a great deal is just the facts of existence.
Well, obviously, we could do an entire podcast just on Jane Austen, because the fact that the memorial on her grave says nothing about her being a writer and talks about what a charitable person she was, it's breathtaking. And the fact that that room that you talk about had a squeaky door. And she liked it having a squeaky door because she didn't want anyone to see what she was doing. So when they'd start to open the door, she'd hear the squeak and she'd put her arm around it. And the idea that you had to hide the fact that you were Jane Flippin' Austen just blows my mind.
I wonder if people have started to communicate with you about the book and sort of say, oh, I think I might give it a try. Or, I mean, I also have friends who have kept diaries for 40 years, which I find very interesting. I never kept a diary. I only allowed myself to make little notes on scraps. And I wish I had done it differently. And that is the truth. I wish I had kept journals now.
Well, I sort of feel like, I think it was Martin Amis who once said to Salman Rushdie, what you want to be able to do is say, from here to here on the shelf, that's me. And in terms of leaving something behind, my children know, from here to here on the shelf, that's her. And they're the people whose memories I care about most clearly. But people who talk to me almost universally are inhibited by the same thing. And that's that they're intimidated, that there's judgment. And one of the things that I hope I communicate in the book that I think is invaluable is me too. Every day there's judgment. Every day I'm intimidated. Every day I sit down and think, I have nothing to say. No one's going to read this. No one cares. And that little bad Jiminy Cricket on your shoulder is always saying, no. And I sort of have to knock him off every time I start writing. And, you know, one of the things I talk about being intimidated is you've got to remember at a threshold level that the only judge is you. Now, that might be the harshest judge you know, but it's the only judge you know. Jacques Barzan said, think about it as though you're writing in clay, not on marble. And I think that you have to keep in mind that if you want, you can write it down and rip it up.
I think all the time that's important. You can write it down and rip it up. You know, we live in the modern world. All you have to do is hit delete. And often when I write, even when I'm working on a piece of fiction, I think to myself, I don't have to show this to anybody. No one ever has to read this except me. And I can always scrap it. But I think that feeling of knowing that you are not writing for an audience. You may turn out to have written for an audience, but you don't have to be writing for anybody. I mean, when I write to my kids, it is for them. It is usually actually about them or sometimes something about me. But there's also the, you know, the sort of sitting down at the desk and writing something and like, you don't have to show that to anybody. That can just be for you yourself.
Exactly. Exactly. And that whole notion, you know, the last chapter of the book, I quote pretty extensively from a collection called Pioneer Women, which is a collection of recollections from the women who settled Kansas in the 19th century. And just like clockwork, right out of the gate, one of them said, oh, well, I have no story. I have nothing to tell. And then you read this collection and it's so rich with that feeling of digging a dugout house to live in and losing your children to diseases that we take for granted have been eradicated today and plagues of grasshoppers and making clothes out of flour sacks. And it's so, so rich. And you think, what you thought was nothing to write about is a whole world to me.
Yeah, I think one of the things I felt about your book was that it was such a useful note in the bottle for so many people just to go, you don't have to do this, but you might want to try. Or just do it for a few weeks. See how it feels. Because it has value. And I think it has value whether it is entirely intimate and it is just your diary or your journal. And if you want to be a real sport about it, you can leave it someplace where somebody can find it eventually, or whether you choose to share it. But maybe that's part of why it does feel to me a little bit like this may, I hope that the book will resonate with men and women, but maybe a tiny bit more with women who just tend to be a little more dismissive sometimes of the things that matter to them. I remember I was talking to a woman and she was saying, you know, I look in the mirror and I catalog all my faults. And she said, when my husband looks in the mirror, he says things like, my calves are really holding up. And I think, who doesn't want that? Who doesn't want to look in the mirror and go through the entire list of things that are falling down and go, those calves, they are awesome. You know, and maybe some of this is the same idea, which is like, it doesn't have to be great. It only has to be yours.
But it not only has value, I'm going to really take a flying leap here and say that it does have the ability to confer a kind of immortality. So, for example, I think in passing one night when we were doing an event together, I met your husband, but I didn't know your husband. And now I feel like I really, really know him. And that's because you wrote about him. And I not only know him, but I know so much about, I had no idea that once they put catalytic converters in cars, couldn't put them in the garage anymore and turn them on and go quietly to sleep. I feel like this is a kind of a message in a bottle too, your book, in ways that I just feel like it's going to be so valuable for so many people at such a deep emotional, but also logistical level.
Well, I hope. I mean, I hope that it will. I mean, for me, it was wanting to tell the love story, but also wanting to say to people, this is worth thinking about. If you are not a very young person, you might want to give this some thought about your own life, the shape of it, how you feel about it, what you see in the future, and being willing to talk about it. And I think that some of that is very much what you're writing about, which is it helps people. It helps people to know. It helps people to read about it. It helps people to think about it. And it makes a difference.
And it feels like control at some level. I mean, that's what your book is about, too. It's about saying, I have control of my own life. I'm going to make it and my death perhaps be what I want it to be. And then discovering that you do not have the power to do that, that you have to fight to be, to do, to have what you want to have. And, you know, I think one of the things about writing is, as you said, it can only belong to you. It can be the power of being yourself on the page and looking at it and thinking, this is a way of understanding myself that only needs to belong to me and that I don't need to share with anyone else, but is valuable to me.
Yeah. And I think both the internal and the external come together. I was going to say to you, did anybody have to persuade you to write at any point in your life, or were you always ready to write for your life?
Well, as I say in the book, at a pretty young age, I started writing in school, which is done too seldom now. I started writing in school and having teachers say to me, this is good. I'm from a hyperverbal Irish Catholic family. Sometimes people say to me, are you from a family of writers? Technically, the answer is no, but I am definitely from a family of storytellers. And I was also one of those little girls who always had a book in her hand. And at a certain point, I just looked at the shelves in the library and thought, yep, me too. And so given teachers' positive reinforcement and given how I felt about reading and about the people who produced books, I didn't need a whole lot of goading. What about you? Well, you had a whole other professional life aside from being a writer.
Yeah. I mean, I was a clinical social worker, which also has to do with listening to stories. And I think the moment at which I decided I wanted to write was really a moment of going, oh, you know, I think I'd like to tell some stories, not other people's stories, you know, stories that I make up. And I feel like that's just sort of driven me all along. I had to learn how to write by writing a terrible mystery that was so bad, I had to buy it back from my publisher. Once I had done the copy edits on it, I thought, oh, no tree should die for this. This is just terrible. And I put it literally in the basement under a bunch of garden hoses for about 20 years. And then when I felt I had learned how to write, I sort of took another look at it. So I am determined at some point to bring that out. And that for me will be like a real pleasure. But I think for the rest of writing, it was sort of things I wanted to say. And I think I read very much in the spirit of your book, which was I wanted to know things. I wanted to know things about how other people did things, what other people thought, how they lived, how they managed. I remember one of the first books I ever read. I remember this because I was sitting on the floor of the library when the librarian came over and said, "What's that you're reading, dear?" And I said, it's an amazing book. It's about this group of girls and they all live together in the city. And I don't know exactly what they do, but they're really best friends. And at the end of the day, their gentleman friends come over and they have kind of a party. And she said, what is the name of this book? And the name of the book was A House Is Not a Home by Polly Adler, Memoirs of a New York Madam. And I did find it very instructive. I mean, puzzling to me, because I think I was about 9, but filled with details of like playing canasta, buying seltzer, filling the icebox. And all of that really stays with me. And that's why I think encouraging people, like just an hour with you and the notebook or you and the computer can change things. Inside and outside.
It absolutely can. It's interesting that you talk about wanting then to tell stories in which you made things up, because people ask me all the time, since I write both fiction and nonfiction and was for many years a newspaper reporter, why I wanted to write fiction. And the answer is, when you're a street reporter and asking people questions, you can only know as much as they're willing to tell you or give you. When you're writing a novel, you can know everything. And that feeling just, it's both terrifying because you don't have a notebook with people's quotes written down in it. And it's liberating because when you are writing down people's quotes in your notebook, you're always aware of the fact that they're only giving you part of the story.
Always. And that is everybody's right. And so the last thing I would want to ask you for this book is, because you have so many great quotes in the book, in addition to your great sentences, did you just... You just have found everybody in the world who has something useful and interesting to say about this kind of writing. Is there, for you, is there one person in your family that you really wish you had the letters, the journal, the diary from?
Yes, of course. I was 19 and my mother was 40 when she died of ovarian cancer. We were very different. And when people said we were very different before she died, it meant one thing. And then when she became canonized after her death, it meant something different. But I would love to have some letters, some journal entries, some sense of her more than I have. My father lived to be 83, and I feel like at some level I knew him down to the ground, but not so much with her.
I think that is the great gift. I mean, I think when you say write for your life, it is not just for your life. It is for other people's lives as well. And I think that's really part of what you convey in the book. Good for you and good for other people. It's hard to beat that as a combination. I could talk to you all day, as you know. So I'm always happy when we get to talk about anything. I feel like, you know, we could probably have done half an hour on sneakers and had a really good time.
I just want to add one thing, which is that when I'm asked about writing fiction and I'm asked by readers about what I think of as a perfect novel, I always come up with two of them. One is Middlemarch by George Eliot, and the other one is Away by Amy Bloom, which I consider to be a book so finely wrought that it takes my breath away. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, thank you for this. I'm so glad we had a chance to talk about books and writing and letters and the internal and the external. We'll do this again sometime.
Okay, thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
Please visit KentuckyAuthorForum.com for more information and for show notes on today's podcast. Please take a minute to rate and review Great Podversations in your podcast app. Great Podversations is distributed by Louisville Public Media. It's a production of University of Louisville Kentucky Author Forum. Mary Moss Greenbaum, producer, Evie Clare, associate producer, and Leslie Sissel, consultant. Great Podversations is supported by the Owsley Brown II family, Bittner's, the Geens Foundation, James Graham Brown Foundation, and LDG Development. We hope you enjoyed this Great Podversation. Thank you for listening. I look forward to you joining me for the next Great Podversation.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.